Aussies love the bush, but sometimes the bloody bush doesn't love us back. I'm John Harper, just a simple joker talking about why mental health is everybody's business and what to do if you think a mate is struggling.
I realised that I had a massive, massive challenge ahead of me if I was going to make some sort of life myself on the land. And Sam, for the first time in his life, had to get used to asking for help. You know, the sun would go down, it was back up again tomorrow, way I'd go again. And if tomorrow wasn't any good, well, the next day would be. So I rolled my sleeves up and there was no bloody way in the world I was going to let a spinal cord injury get in the road of what I'd always wanted. If there was an explosion in front of me right now, John, and a genie popped out of a bottle and said, well, Sam, it's your lucky day. I'll grant you a wish and take you back and give you your legs and all the rest of it. Terribly sorry. Hop back in your bottle and bugger off.
This podcast is a Room 3 production and brought to you by our mates at the Department of Primary Industries and their Rural Resilience Team and the Murrumbidgee Primary Health Network. In this podcast, you'll be hearing the lived experiences of everyday folk in rural and remote Australia. The language can be strong at times and the references of suicide may upset some people, so consider who's within earshot when listening. Any advice in this podcast is of a general nature and is not an excuse for you not seeing your own GP or medical professional. We've got plenty of links on the Mate Helping Mate website of trusted service providers across the country. Head to matehelpingmate.org.au.
G'day podcasters, John Harper at Cropper Creek today. Sitting with a bloke, Sam Bailey, and Sam is an interesting cove in that he's endured and overcome a physical crisis none of us would want to endure. But I find Sam interesting because he's never acknowledged he's had an issue with mental well-being. He's never been diagnosed with depression. Sam is definitely a bloke whose glass is always half full. But you'll hear through his stories, his strategies of maintaining his well-being. Sam's positive strategies align perfectly with those used in overcoming poor mental health, poor mental well-being. These strategies are used by everybody, regardless of their mental health status, whether they're in Cropper Creek or not. Hey, Sam?
Dead right, John, the mighty Cropper Creek. Yeah, I'm born and bred here, grew up, went to the little Cropper Creek school, and so it's a wonderful area. It's a predominantly dryland grain-growing area, so wheat, barley, chickpeas grown here during winter. And then we get a summer rain as well, so we can turn around and then grow sorghum, sunflowers, cotton, mung beans through summer. So it's quite a special place.
Is it a tough place? So your dual cropping area, we're just a winter cropping area, and where I live, Stock and Bingle's regarded as a safe area. And to a certain extent, I suppose it might make us or the people around here a little bit softer because we're in God's own country, we think. What's Copper Creek regarded as? Tough country for them?
Yeah, we think the same up here, John. We think we've got the land of milk and honey too, but because we can grow two crops. But as you know, farming's not easy. We play the game with Mother Nature, and Mother Nature can be terribly, terribly kind, but she can be awfully bloody cruel, and we've seen that in the last few years. But I guess I've seen that all my life. If I had a dollar for everyone that said to me over the years, oh, geez, isn't there an easier game than farming, I'd be a millionaire. But I just love it, John. It was in my blood from the time that I entered the world, and it'll stay here till I die. It is a tough game, but you know, it certainly toughens you up, and I just love it, really do.
So what kind of characteristics? Are you just born with it and you don't need any special characteristics to be a farmer, or are there certain traits that you need? Because it is true, some people take on farming and make a good go of it, yet they're not from a farming family.
To a certain extent, I think you're born with it. You know, and I often ask, you know, what is it? What is it about farming? Is it the wonderful childhood you have growing up? Is it the love and nurture of animals, the fascination growing crops? From a very early age, I saw mum and dad cope with fires and floods and droughts and, you know, dealing with livestock. There are live ones and there are dead ones. And I saw that growing crops, you can almost have a perfect crop and then, you know, a storm one night, a hail storm, and it's all wiped out. You know, I guess that's the game we like to play, that it is, you are dealing with Mother Nature. But I just love it. It gets into your blood and you can't get rid of it.
In regards to mental well-being, they often use the term resilient. Do you see yourself or your father as a resilient man, or were they tough men?
Yeah, it was interesting, resilience. I mean, it was a word, it wasn't around when I was growing up, and I certainly wouldn't know how to spell it if it was, but I think it was that toughness. I think it was the toughness that you learn. And I remember I had an interesting experience that happened to me. I had a pet dog, Wally. You know, you do have pets when you're younger, and they're the last thing you think of when you close your eyes at night, the first thing you think of when you open your eyes in the morning. And anyway, I got up one morning, I go over and let Wally off the chain. He was dead. And oh my God. So I tore back and got Dad, and Dad came out, and straight away, you know, I could see Dad. I see what he meant now. He was teaching you to sort of, you know, I suppose you mourn, you toughen up, and you learn how to get on with it. And straight away he said, well, look, Wally hasn't struggled. It was a quick death. You can't, you know, remember this day. Now you've got to remember all the fun times you had with him. He used to love that tree over there, so how about we bury him over there? And by the time all that happened, you were silly, now we're back on top of the hill again. And 2 weeks later, he had another pup, and away you go again. So it was that learning to grieve and be sorry, but it was, you also toughen you up, but you learn how to get on with it. You know, and I learned that from an very early age, and it stuck with me all the way through. And I suppose when there is a bit of toughness come along, you always try and see something good quickly out of something bad. And I guess I've done that all my life. And yeah, I guess you are born with it, but you on a farm you learn it from a very early age, and I think it was that toughness I learned a kid that little did I know, you know, a few years down the track that I was going to draw on that.
It's interesting, isn't it? So people outside of farming often think that we're cruel or we're heartless or we're that tough, we don't have any feelings. But the story about Wally, I suppose, highlights grief and the process of grieving, in that anybody, you never forget. You still remember Wally. You've never forgotten, but you've moved forward from that, as you say.
Yeah, Wally was the first thing that happened, but there have been many, many similar situations that have happened through my life. And, you know, anyone with livestock will tell you that you have this enormous love affair with them, but unfortunately they're going to get bogged in dams, they're going to break legs, and they're going to have trouble calving, and they're going to... So when you got live ones, you got dead ones as well, and that's just part of running livestock. So I guess it does toughen you up, because you are dealing day-to-day with life and death, and that's farming. I suppose to a certain extent, people just growing crops, you know, and they grieve when they get a hailstorm and lose one as well. But we all know that before we set off to grow a crop in a new year, you know that it's never over till you got it in the bin, you know, and lots of things can happen through that time. But farmers just have this amazing strength and character. When the chips are down, you learn to cope somehow, and you learn to go on with it. Next year is a new year, and we'll grow another crop. And it'll be a beauty as well. So it's just always trying to find something good and something bad.
So I suppose it comes back, when we talk about toughness and resilience, is the definition. So, I mean, at first take, toughen up, you think, oh, the farmer's got to be that tough, nothing gets through his thick hide. But that's not true. You can be a tough farmer, but you still feel things. You still have your moments of sadness. So in regards, say, to Wally, and even now, you know, I know you've got a couple of dogs there, and if something happened to one of them, you'd be flat. But then within a period of time, you'd be prepared to move forward. And it's the same, I suppose, with the term resilience, is that I get really peeved because most people talk about resilience as this ability to bounce back. But I very rarely see anybody who's been down bounce back. It seems to be a clawing or a slow process of getting back. What's your take on bouncing business?
Well, you don't necessarily bounce back. You know, I had my life all planned from a very young age. So I get through my schooling a year or two or three out in the big wide world, and then I return home to, you know, back home and take the reins from Dad, marry, family. Unfortunately, partway through the plan, it didn't go all that well. I was involved in a car accident and broke my neck, and it left me a quadriplegic. You know, which means I've limited use of my arms and hands now, and paralyzed my chest down. And it threatened to shatter that lifelong dream that I had of being a farmer. But, you know, I had 5 months in a spinal unit, and then my dream came true, right? The spinal unit door was open, and I arrived home to the farm at Cropper Creek. But I can tell you, it was never, ever in the plan to arrive home in a wheelchair. You know, I arrived home, and those first couple of weeks were just an absolute bloody nightmare. You know, I got home, I couldn't do anything. I had no way of getting around the farm. I had no car. I was housebound. No longer was I big brother, guardian angel to a younger brother and sister. No longer now was Sam a gladiator. Instead, now I'm used to people stopping and staring and looking at me and not knowing what to say. And Sam, for the first time in his life, had to get used to asking for help. So there I was in the absolute prime of life with the horrible realization now that my life was never going to be the way it was. My body from the chest down was never, ever going to do what it once did, but was still going to come along for the ride with me and be absolutely no help to me. I realized that I had a massive, massive challenge ahead of me if I was going to make some sort of life myself on the land. But I guess that's where that early childhood growing up of toughness and learning to get on with it kicked in. So I rolled my sleeves up and there was no bloody way in the world I was going to let a spinal cord injury get in the road of what I always wanted. So with a Sydney Harbour full of determination and another one beside it full of a never give up attitude, I set about to rebuild a badly broken life. And going back to your question, John, you know, you don't just go to bed one night and it's all back together the next morning. It took me 6 or 8 months to get my life back on track.
You said about how you had to learn to ask for help. Now, you were in a impossible situation, but how hard was that for you to ask for help?
Oh, look, at 19, you're 6 foot tall and bulletproof. You're bigger, stronger, faster than Superman, and you're tough and got that gladiator status. I mean, it was enormously different to ask for help, but it was really, really hard. But I had to do it. I knew I had to ask for help because it was going to help me get my life back to normality. And I think, you know, the first question I asked was the toughest of them all. But then, you know, the next one wasn't too bad. The next one got a bit easier. And the next one got a bit easier. And I found that it was giving me a lift as well. But I guess a lot easier for me, John, people can see that I'm in a wheelchair. You know, I guess an able-bodied person, if someone can look at them and say, well, there's nothing wrong with you, you know, what is wrong with you? But a chair for me was a giveaway, I guess. But as I found, John, the first one was bloody tough, but that it got easy from there. And I still do. You know, I'm 33 years down the track, and I still ask for help.
When it was difficult to ask for help, one of the things that you did pick up was, to a certain extent, it made you happy being able to ask for help because you could see that the people wishing to help you actually enjoyed being able to contribute positively to you, I suppose, that it helped other people as well, helping you.
You get much more of a thrill out of helping someone else than you do yourself. But initially it's that first question. But once you get over that, I just see the enormous pleasure and the people get helping you because it is great to know that you can go and help someone and how much better it makes their life. It makes them feel good as well. So it's just asking that first question.
What you've just talked about is what I've witnessed in regards to mental well-being is that once people are able to ask for help that first time, or whether there's somebody reaching out and asking, are you okay, for the first time, once they get over that bit of a hump, there seems to be a two-way street of benefit, I suppose, of positive activity. I suppose one of the reasons we are talking is that you have an obvious physical disability, and I'm trying to show through our discussion that some of the strategies you use to deal with that and to deal with all the other negatives that come with that are basically the same as what we do with somebody dealing with poor mental well-being, with depression, with anxiety. And I know you've often told me that you've never really been down. You've always had a positive. I've got no doubt that the listeners can hear that you've got a bouncy voice. You certainly don't sound like a bloke that's played with misery and negativity. No way knowing.
No, look, I've been very lucky. I don't know what I've never struggled with depression. I've never had depression. Frustrated out of my head, but never depressed. And I suppose, as I said earlier, I've always tried to find something good and something bad. And I suppose earlier on for me, just two simple things that helped me enormously when I first got home from the spinal unit. You know, day after day, just become pear-shaped. And whether it was falling out of bed all the time trying to get dressed, falling out of my chair all the time trying to get used to my paralysis. I remember I gave myself a third-degree burn in the shower one night, again trying to get used to no sensation. I had days in bed jammed full of antibiotics trying to get rid of bladder infections. I had bowel accidents, which are terribly embarrassing. I mean, I can go on, but I had to learn to get over those days. And I found when I fell out of bed, I just laugh. Think, right, mate, you beat me today, but by gee, look out tomorrow. And the other thing that I invented, it's a bit of an analogy of the bush, I suppose. It's what I call jumping the fence. And what I mean by that is when it all goes pear-shaped in your own paddock, or so you think, jump over the fence and into someone else's paddock. And for 10, 20, 30 seconds, that's all it has to be. I'd give some thought to the turmoil happening around the world at the time. You know, the wars, the poverty, the hunger, all the millions of people in refugee camps. There are days when I wouldn't leave the shores of this country. I'd just think of the families that lost loved ones in tragic accidents, all the people battling terminal illnesses. There are days when I'd just simply jump back to the spine unit where I was. You know, in the bed beside me was a fellow called Gary. Gary was a high-level quad who had no movement from his neck down and would be 24/7 care for the rest of his life. In fact, he was so disabled, he had a little machine called a respirator that would help him breathe for the rest of his life because he had all his muscles around his lungs were so paralyzed that he needed help to breathe. And I remember being on the deck with him one afternoon and he said to me, Sam, I'm just terrified this machine's going to stop because I just can't breathe by myself. So what you very bloody quickly do then is jump back over the fence and back into your paddock. And all of a sudden, a day or two in bed with a butt infection or falling out of a chair trying to get dressed seems so bloody insignificant. You know, the sun would go down, it was back up again tomorrow, way I'd go again. And if tomorrow wasn't any good, well, the next day would be. I have bad days. I have days where it all goes bloody pear-shaped. So I just jump the fence and it helps, you know, I jump back and it helps me a lot and always know tomorrow will be a better day. And I don't think it hurts having a bad day every now and then to make you appreciate the wonderful life you do have. I had a stumble 5 weeks ago. I fell off my bloody horse trying to get into the tractor and broke my pelvis in a couple of places. So I've been in bed for the last 6 weeks. But it certainly makes you appreciate the life I've got. And I'm very lucky. And the pelvis will heal. And before I know it, I'll be back on the tractor. And, yeah, we always just try to look forward rather than looking back. So I know someone up there is probably guiding traffic and maybe 30 years ago, someone said, well, Sam, we're going to knock you down. You're going to have to do a few hard yards to get the show back on the road, but then we want you to go out and help other people through their tough times as well. So, and I now have this life where if there was an explosion in front of me right now, John, and a genie popped out of a bottle and said, well, Sam, it's your lucky day. I'll grant you a wish and take you back and give you your legs and all the rest of it. Terribly sorry. Pop back in your bottle and bugger off. There's no way now I'd ever go back. I have this amazing life, married a beautiful girl. You know, I've been for the last 20 years traveling around speaking, giving inspiration to others. So I think that's been my purpose. And look, we're not being sent off to war. We're not living in refugee camps. We're so lucky to live in this great country that does offer us all so much. So, and that's where I am today, John.
This podcast has been made possible thanks to our mates at the Department of Primary Industries and their Rural Resilience team. The Rural Resilience Program builds stronger primary industries by co-designing new products and services that support and enhance the growth of farming businesses. The Rural Resilience team listens to the needs of primary producers, learns about services and programs that could assist, and links farmers with the most appropriate services and information. This podcast is also brought to you by the Murrumbidgee Primary Health Network, also known as the MPHN for short. The MPHN Empowering Our Communities Grant is the federal government's way of walking the talk, demonstrating their commitment to supporting families and communities living with the impacts of drought, with a focus on mental health and well-being. It's a whole-of-community approach to mental health and suicide prevention, encouraging and empowering local and rural communities to look for proactive approaches to mental health support and suicide prevention.
If I go right back to some of the starts, you said one of your strategies you said now is that sometimes when you're down, when you're a bit flat, you ring mates. What I want to ask you, one question here is, what is the result of ringing a mate? Do they get flat too?
Well, it gives me a lift. And it's finding out that maybe, you know, after a little while they'll say, well, geez, I had a shit day the other day, my best bull died, or I've just had a hailstorm and my crop's wiped out, or... So I guess it just lifts me, it lifts them, and you realize, it makes you realize that, you know, not everyone's having a great day either. And most important thing in our life are mates and friends and family. And don't know what it is that really in the beginning that made me do that. I just find it's quite easy to pick up the phone and dial their phone number, and there's nothing like having a great yak with a great mate.
So it's a plan B to your strategy of jumping the fence, isn't it? But it's a practical one, one that you can hear on the end of the phone. You're kind of jumping the fence by talking with your mates, and you can see that they have issues sometimes, or they can see that you've got an issue, so then you end up, yeah, all joyful, you know. It's like, you know, I've had a terrible day, and then the mate says, oh, yeah, but me missus bloody wiped the car out, kangaroo hit it, and then you end up having a laugh because the bloke says, oh, well, I knocked his grotum off and I've made a purse out of it for her.
It's a laugh. It's just that laugh.
And that goes back to your first one where you said laughter and humour. So, I mean, actually you've thought outside of the box, but you're reinforcing your own primary strategies, isn't it, of jumping the fence and laughter and humour to buoy yourself through when things are a bit flatter.
That's it. That's it.
And that's the whole concept of life, isn't it? Regardless of what the big fella upstairs has dished out to us, is that to a certain extent we need to accept what's happened in the past and be prepared to move forward. It doesn't mean that we necessarily forget, but that's part of life, is that we need to have strategies in place that we can move forward and perhaps to a better future.
That's right. I mean, life is full of thrills and spills, and luckily for us all, the thrills will far outweigh the spills. You know, it's just a fact of life. Sometimes it's not all that bad. It's just trying to find something good and something bad, and you will move on and you will look back. And to be honest, I could never have done what I've done without the support of my parents, who laid a platform for me, my brother and sister behind me, all my mates who are helping me. They carry the baton and they hand it to you, and you're the one that's then got to run with the baton. It makes an enormous difference if you have got that family and mate support. You know, I've had that through all my life.
And the value of that is that they know the caliber of the person within. So your family know full well the measure of Sam Bailey. And that's the value of family and mates with all of us, is that they're the ones that know us best. One of the things in moving forward, they often say, is the setting of goals, but they need to be realistic. And it's interesting, Sam, that some of the goals that you've set to a bloke at me at first instance seem out of this world, unrealistic. How the hell can that happen? But one of the things that I'd like to touch on was the value of family, of your dad tempting you with a goal at the very first instance. So when you had your accident, you came back to the farm. For some unknown reason, he'd got a new quad bike and he put it in the shed. And I'm bloody sure he did that because he knew he's going to bait Sam to get out of that bed and do something. What was the story there?
Well, I mean, obviously Dad had preempted that when Sam gets home, you know, he had no car, so it was no, you know, the independent side of his life was going to be, he was going to be housebound, which was right. But Dad had preempted that. Even Dad at that stage didn't know the extent of my full, you know, because Mum and Dad only saw me two or three times when I was in the spinal unit, so they really had no idea of, you know, how disabled I was. Anyway, he brought this bike home, and it was a lure, I guess, and I suppose he'd taken a punt. I'd been told that the four motorbikes really was someone of your level. You know, how are you going to get on it? How are you going to ride it with, you know, hands that don't work properly? Anyway, I sat in the shed and I went over the next morning and I went to get something out of the shed and I wheeled past this bike and I turned around and looked at it and it was bloody tempting me, as you said, John. So I thought, I'm going to regard getting on this thing. So I pulled up beside it. I mean, it was a daunting transfer to get my bum up in the seat. They don't teach you stuff like that at the spinal unit. But anyway, I thought I was going to have a crack. My first three or four attempts failed. I lost my balance, fell onto the concrete floor, fell out of my chair onto the concrete floor. But I managed to get myself back in my chair. And then on my fifth or sixth go, I actually got my bum up in the seat. And I pushed myself up and I grabbed hold of the handlebars straight away. And straight away I was amazed on how safe I felt. So I sat there for a moment. I thought, oh, well, you better keep going, mate. So I grabbed my other leg. I threw it over the bike, sort of adjusted myself. It was a Suzuki motorbike, so I started up. The reverse mechanism was a lever you just pulled between your legs. I pulled into reverse, slowly backed it out of the shed, pushed the lever forward, reached down to the, because it hadn't been modified at that stage. Unlike the bikes, a lot of them are all automatic. This was a geared one, so I reached down and pulled the gear stick up into, I don't know, first or second gear and sat back up. Took a deep breath and I said, oh, well, here you goes. I went about 10 metres and I had a 10-metre smile on my face. So Dad took it back into town, got it modified and brought it back. I had a 10-metre smile on my face, but I reckon he would have had a 15-metre smile on his face. So that got the wheel turning. You know, it didn't start turning flat out, but it got the wheel turning, and then that made me up here just think, righto, you don't look back, you look forward. And I think it was also me realizing don't dismiss an idea. Don't dismiss anything, whether it's mentally or physical, till you've had a go. Because I often look back and wonder how different my life might have been had I just accepted, oh, no, I can't get on that bike and I can't use it. You know, how different my life might have been. So we speak to lots and lots of kids right through the country now. And it's one of the things I say to them, don't ever dismiss something till you've had a go. Because if you have a go, 9 times out of 10, you'll succeed. That other one time you may not. I use the example that I wanted to get back on a horse after I had my accident. So I found a disabled riding school. Out I went with a couple of mates. I literally lifted me out of my chair on top of this horse. The only place I could hang on to was the pommel of the saddle. I had one mate holding me up this side, another one this side. I had no sensation because I got no feeling. So I had no sensation of being on the horse. The lady leading it, she led me for about 5 metres and I said, no, hang on, pull up. This is bloody hopeless. So I remember saying to myself, well, Sam, you forget about chasing that rainbow and go and chase another one. And so that's the example I give kids. That there might be this one time that it won't work, but anyway, as long as you've had a crack, keep pursuing and you will succeed. And I hope my story's been an example of that.
So that story falls into what we talk to people about in that you've got to have realistic goals and you've got to work that out, but you've also got to reflect on your own abilities so that you hopped on a motorbike and you had the ability to ride it and you recognise that. If you think you can, you probably will. Now, you still had that mentality and you hopped on a horse, but it didn't take you very long to accept the reality that horse riding was not going to work for you. So then you accepted that quite readily because you'd already reflected on the abilities you had. And I think that's one of the strategies that people need to understand in moving forward when they're flat and they're down. They've got to understand what's their strengths in their character and what areas do they just have to accept that, you know, I suppose it's not politically correct, are weaker, I suppose, that they need to work on. So there's some of the things that I like in your story. So what is the latest Sam Bailey goal?
Well, I'd hear a saying many years ago, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. So 12 years ago, I was speaking at a school in Coonabarabin and I was speaking to the kids. And while I was speaking, I looked out the window and I saw their oval. And I'd always wanted to get back to flying. I'd flown an off-flight aircraft and always knew I'd get back in the air. Some stages there would come an opportunity to do that. Anyway, I was looking at this oval and I thought, we can't fly an aeroplane into an oval, but why don't you learn to fly a helicopter and fly it into the school oval? Fly in, land, hop out into your chair, call all the kids over, tell them your story, then hop back in and fly off. And I just knew that it would be an image that would stay with me for the rest of my life, but a message for them, hopefully, as you fly away, gee, if Sam can do what he's doing, I can do anything. That's a goal, and it's a goal I've got, and we're still working on it 12 years later, but it won't bloody beat me. It is a world first, and I've learned that world firsts don't happen every day of the week because they're bloody hard. But we are getting very, very close, but it will happen. It won't beat me. There's no bloody way it's going to be. I haven't hung in here for 12 years, and you got to stick at stuff. You know, don't just try something once and give up. You know, if it falls over, try again and try again and try. Just keep trying until it happens, and so I'm going to demonstrate that, and hopefully they'll see that it did take 12 years, and it wasn't easy. You know, it's financially, it's been hard, but I always knew in the beginning it wasn't going to be a walk in the park, and it's a world first. All these people who tell me, oh, you won't do it, there's no way you'll do it, mate, can't be done. Well, pig's ass, it can't be done.
The main reason, I suppose, that I wanted this discussion was that your individual story is an analogy, really, in what happens to people in regards to mental health, is that we have these setbacks and we have to use different strategies. We have to use the people around us. We have to use the strength around us to get us going and to achieve some goals. And sometimes it just so happens that we have to accept the shit that's happened to us, is that we have to find a way to accept that and move forward and enjoy what we're given.
look, nothing in life's perfect, and I would say to someone, if you've got a mental illness and you're taking medication and it's helping you, well, that's great. You know, I can't pee, so I've got to catheterize myself now every day. But that's what I've got to do to get through the day, you know. And I accept that I've got no bowel control, and I accept that I've got no feeling, and I accept that I've got no, I can't regulate my body temperature, and I accept that I only got 45% of my lung capacity left. But look, that's it. That's my ideal in life, and I've accepted that. But I can still function, I can still have a go, and I can still love, I can still ring a mate, and I can still give help to someone. John, you've had bladder and cancer, you know, and you've got a bag now, but if that enables you to live, well, so be it, you know. And we've all got to accept that nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect in life. And if taking medication or whatever you do through your life enables you to get through life, enables you to have a family and to love and to be someone in the community, you know, so be it. I think there are too many people out there that just think life's perfect and it's got to be perfect, but it's not. Nothing in life is perfect, and nothing in life as a farmer will be perfect. Nothing in life as a doctor will be perfect. Nothing in life as a dentist. You've got to have those bad days every now and then to appreciate a good one. Use some simple mechanisms to get you through a bad day into the next one. Then you look back and say, well, it was a shit day last week, but I'm having a bloody beauty now. Maybe stop and smell roses.
I want to thank you, Sam, for divulging a lot of your story. I mean, we go back a lot of years. In the last drought, we went round and helping people with their well-being, their general well-being. As I said, the analogy that people could make between your lived physical life and their mental ups and downs with life was incredible. And nearly everybody, well, actually everybody, basically came away inspired and felt that, yes, if we can just get to the point where we think we can be like Sam, we can achieve anything. And as I said, over the years, I can't get over how close this bloody helicopter thing is. When I first heard it, I thought, yeah, this fella's just peeing in the wind. He's peeing in the wind. But it just shows you that structure, teamwork, commitment to an achievable goal, which, you know, you've decided on, is possible. So, Sam, I introduced you first as a beef producer at Cropper Creek because, as I said, I mainly wanted people to understand that we all have the same problems and we probably use the same strategies. And the business about being a quadriplegic and that, for me, is nothing. It was your analogy of jumping the fence. I wanted you, the listeners, to be able to jump the fence, put yourself in Sam's shoes and possibly learn from some of his strategies on how you may like to deal with your issues with life. So, Sam Bailey, thanks a lot, mate. Pleasure.
Yeah, good on you, John. It's been a wonderful thrill to be on the program with you, and I really value the mates that we've become. You know, if I can throw in some strategies, people, they're not scientific. It's about having a belly laugh. It's about jumping the fence. It's about just ringing a mate. It's about maybe ringing a family member that you haven't done for a while. It's just about, you know, some simple stuff that can get you through. And I wish everyone all the very best. And maybe go out and help someone, because I know the pleasure I get out of helping someone is more than I get helping myself. And we can all do that.
That is true. And I suppose ultimately I would say to you people out there, if there are days where you hit the wall, where you can't get out of bed, think of Sam and think about his predicament and the strategies he used to learn how to ask for help when he needed it. So thanks, Sam.
All right, beauty.
If you're struggling with your mental health and need to talk now, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. They're available 24/7. In finishing, a reminder that this podcast features general information only, and we recommend that you get independent advice from a qualified professional. Mate Helping Mate has plenty of links on our website with a number of great service providers across the country. Head to matehelpingmate.org.au. This podcast was a Room 3 production and brought to you by our mates at the Department of Primary Industries, their Rural Resilience Program, and the Murrumbidgee Primary Health Network. You can find out more about these organisations and the great work they do on our website. Other episodes of this podcast can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts by searching for Mate Helping Mate and hitting subscribe. If you like what you've heard, make sure you leave a rating to make it easier for others to find us. Better yet, share it with your friends and family to start a conversation about mental health in the bush. This podcast was produced by Aaron Johnson and AJ Clifford for Room 3, a production company that works with not-for-profits and social enterprise across Australia. A massive thanks to John Harper, who over the years has travelled this country tirelessly working to improve mental health in rural and remote Australia. And of course, his offsider Michelle, for her continued support for John and his work, and her hospitality for our crew and guests at the farm during recording. Recorded and edited by AJ Clifford, original music by Southwark Sounds, and stock by Soundstripe. Thank you for listening, hoping you can move forward, and we hope that this makes a difference.